We talked to this guy a couple of weeks ago, and I don't believe there's anyone more informed on R. Kelly and his troubles and everything that happened there than this guest. We talked to him on the radio. A half hour was not enough time. This is the most informed man anywhere in journalism on the subject of R. Kelly. His name is Jim DeRogatis, and he's got a new book out. And I wanted to talk to him in a longer format so that basically, if you want anything in the way of information about R. Kelly, it's all here from this guy, a guy who was unsurprised by anything in the federal indictment because he'd already reported on it. So here is Jim DeRogatis right after Mike Ryan tells you a little bit about ZipRecruiter.
As Dan mentioned, Jim DeRogatis, he wrote a great book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. Make sure to check that out and support Jim, who was kind enough to give us this much time. I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. As you guys know, hiring can be hard. Multiple job sites, they stack resumes, and it's a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/Beach. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find the people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. And as those applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each and every one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, we want South Beach Session listeners to go out there and try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire.
Jim DeRogatis joins us. His new book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, is available now. And if you were not familiar, he was on with us, and he was exceptional, and his details, his reporting are thorough, and I don't think I've seen anybody doing it as well as he has been doing it on this subject for a long time. So I want to get a little bit more, because there wasn't room on the radio to do this with you, Jim, into how this happened, because the idea that pedophilia, I know you talked about the idea that we are complicit in some ways, and it was all out in front of our eyes, but how do you think he became what he was, him personally, what happened to him?
I go into this in the book, Dan. It seems like he had, in some ways, a very difficult upbringing. His mother had 4 children. He was the 3rd, all by different husbands. And his father was absent throughout his entire upbringing. We think of the South Side of Chicago now, Chirac, you know, the violence. But it is so much more than that. You know, Soulless is a book about Chicago as much as it's a book about anything else. And, you know, the backyard barbecues, the tight-knit parishes that will pay rent or medical bills if a parishioner needs help. The music, everywhere the music. And it seems as if he was sexually abused as a child, 7, 8, 9, by an older family member, a woman. His brother, Carrie, has said it was his sister. He also was abused by an older man in the neighborhood, which he talks much less about. Some of this he writes about in his autobiography, Solar Coaster, My Diary of Me. The research I've had to do into how these predilections take shape, covering this story since November 2000, all of the experts say we know very little about pedophilia because it is considered such a toxic crime in our society that science has not really even been able to research it. What they do say, psychiatrists I've talked to, and there's been 6 of them, is that it is such an extreme compulsion, predilection, that the pedophile does not stop, that he can emerge from jail after 15 years and risk it all again for 15 minutes with another young woman. And that victims of child sexual abuse go one of 2 ways. Many of them become active in trying to help others avoid or heal from the same fate that they underwent. And some of them, and this is, you know, any armchair psychiatrist, but this is what the pros tell me, some of them who've been victimized become victimizers, themselves.
So help me understand this part of it. Do you believe that fame distorted him going the latter route instead of the former?
I think that played a big part of it. Whether it's in your primary field, I know you're interested in much more, sports, or mine, music. We could have a film critic. We could have my old colleague and hero, Roger Ebert, here saying the same thing. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And when you are surrounded by nothing but yes men who cater to your every whim and are determined not to see the gravy train derailed, all morality goes out the window. What's unconscionable in Kelly's case is that the first lawsuit by an underage girl was filed in 1996, and he settled that with an out-of-court payment and a non-disclosure agreement that she would never talk about it. And she didn't until she talked to me early this year. That should have been a wake-up call. The narrow escape of scandal when he married illegally Aaliyah, his protege, in 1996 should have been a wake-up call. Certainly our first story about this pattern of behavior in December 2000 should have been a wake-up call. In February 2002, he was indicted on 21 counts of making child pornography because of a videotape, 26 minutes and 39 seconds long, of him having sexual contact with a 14-year-old and urinating in her mouth, that came to me at my home on the northwest side of Chicago. He's indicted on 21 counts of making child porn. It takes 6 years to go to trial. He's acquitted. That should have been a wake-up call. But he never stopped. As the experts told me, this compulsion, this illegal pursuit, is so strong that nothing stops the predator. And what's especially striking in Kelly's case is that it happened in full view of the world. He sells 100 million records, collaborates with everyone from Whitney Houston and Celine Dion to Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber, earns $250 million himself and a full $1 billion for his label, Jive Records, which is a really problematic institution. If you recall, brought us NSYNC and Britney Spears and the Backstreet Boys and, of course, R. Kelly. You know, and the whole Lou Pearlman as manager of Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, he dies in jail, dies in disgrace for fraud, but was also accused of preying on underage boys. As with the Jeffrey Epstein case, we're seeing a glimpse into the one percenters moneyed people's world of trampling on children for their own sexual pleasure and an army of enablers that help them do it. It's really very horrifying.
Let me ask you a couple of questions here that are quickly answered. Aaliyah, how did that happen? How was that allowed at 15 years old? How did he marry a 15-year-old? I know Jerry Lee Lewis did this, and you'll find this sometime in music, but how does that happen?
She lied about her age on a Cook County marriage certificate. Said she was 18. She was actually 15. She was his protege. She was enrolled at the Detroit Academy of Fine Arts High School. And he produced her debut album, which he wrote and titled Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. The family was shocked and heard about this within 24 hours, separated them, wrote it off to him being a big, dumb kid himself, and Aaliyah getting swept away in the moment. A settlement was struck out of court. According to the paperwork, it was $100 that Kelly paid Aaliyah. But I have heard that it was $2 million or more. She separates from him and never sees him again. Although this happened within 24 hours, she went back to her parents. And her uncle, Barry Hankerson, was Kelly's manager. He continued to work with Kelly from that illegal wedding in 1996 until 2000. When he was confronted with that first lawsuit, the evidence of Tiffany Hawkins and other 15-year-olds, Kelly having had sexual contact with them, and he realized this wasn't an isolated incident with my niece, which he was furious about, needless to say. This is a problem. This is a monster. He resigned in a letter to Kelly's attorneys and Jive Records saying, this man needs help. So that's 2000, you know, and here we are 2019. And he's still saying he's innocent and doesn't need help. He's misunderstood.
What did the payouts look like? How many of them were there, and what did they look like?
I have documentation of 6 lawsuits. You know, initially it was chump change. It was $250,000 to a girl that he had sexual contact with at age 15. And mind you, 25 or 30% of that goes to the attorney who struck the settlements. There are a lot of villains in Solis. One of them is a civil attorney who, she essentially set up a settlement factory. Girls would come to her, Susan Loggins in Chicago. She was on TV. She had lots of big ads. She was one of those kind of attorneys. Girls would come to her with their story. She would make them take a lie detector test. She would present the evidence and any documentation they had to the Kelly camp. The Kelly camp would write a check and send a non-disclosure agreement, and the girl would promise not to talk about it in exchange for this money. I know of 6. I believe there are a dozen. Susan Loggins only says in my book, numerous. But I believe there were a dozen. That was one way to handle his problem, is to pay off these young girls. It's the same tool that Harvey Weinstein used in Hollywood.
What are the strangest ways in your reporting that you have found that he would isolate these women? Because the stories sound crazy.
They do sound crazy. And Dan, I'll tell you, when I first heard from a mother in November 2016, Jonjolin Savage, Joy Savage's mother, and she was using the words brainwashed and cult, I thought, this is nuts. But in July 2017, after 9 months of reporting, I broke that story in BuzzFeed about what has since become called R. Kelly's sex cult. At that point, in the summer of 2017, he was living with 6 women. One of them was underage when she began, but the others were of legal age. And it seems to me that he thought he'd gotten smart, and by the mid-2010s, he was no longer preying on underage girls, as he had up to and including during his trial, because the one girl he met who was 15, he met at the trial when he was facing 15 years behind bars for making child porn. He changed his pattern of behavior and began to date just barely legal women. Date, that sounds so benign. Began to house 6 women at a time, some of them barely legal, some of them a little older, controlling every aspect of the way they lived. This is borne out now in the federal indictments. How they dressed, who they talked to. They were not allowed to speak to any other man. If one of his entourage, a male friend, came into the room, they were to face the wall. They were to wear baggy gym clothes so no one but him could see their form. They were taught by an older den mother, one of the 6, how to pleasure him in sexual encounters that he recorded. And they were separated from friends and family, given a phone they were only to use with him. Their phone was taken, told when to eat, when to sleep, when to go to the bathroom, and how to pleasure him, and he would record those encounters. When the second or third young woman made a comparison to Manson, I began to believe it, because when the first did, I was like the word cult, like the word brainwashed. I thought, this is melodramatic. This can't be real. And then you talk to 14 people on the record, as many of whom have documentary evidence, photos, pictures, texts, emails, recordings of phone calls with Kelly. And you say, my God, how was this happening in Atlanta, where he was living half the time by 2017, and in Chicago at the Trump Tower and at a recording studio that he rented here?
Brainwash how? How does one brainwash someone else? And where does that stuff come from that he was doing? Like, I understand the overall control issue, but where's that coming from?
I think he wants people who are completely subservient to him. And some of the techniques that young women have described is he plays for sympathy. He did not graduate high school. He did 1 year. He cannot read. He cannot write. He suffers from something he calls more than dyslexia. And he had this sexual abuse in his past. And all of this is played for sympathy. There is a charisma, a sort of charm. Manson had 29 high school or college-age girls as part of the family. And we look at this and we say, how did this ever happen? I mean, this seems like a Stephen King story, but it's real. And there is this power and this charisma. And if these girls break his rules by talking to someone or not dressing the way he wants or not doing what he wants sexually, he hits them, he beats them, he withholds food, he punishes them. I sat with Dominique Gardner, who is the girl seen leaving him at the end of Surviving R. Kelly, and she's not spoken to anybody but me. I tell this story in the book, and she's really bright. She's 27 when I met her, and early this year. She was with him for 9 years since she was 17. She said, he loved me and I loved him. And I look and she says, yeah, you know, and he hit me, beat me with an extension cord, starved me, choked me if I broke his rules, but I loved him and he loved me. And the third or fourth conversation we had, I mean, I asked every time, Dominique, you're a smart, bright woman. Why did you stay? The fourth conversation, she finally called up his mugshot when he was arrested by the state of Illinois and showed it to me on her cell phone and said, it's them eyes, Jim. It's them eyes. And that's, Dan, when I said this is like what it must have been like to talk to Squeaky Fromm or one of the girls in Manson's family. You know, and when Dominique's best friend, Geronda, who is now part of the Illinois indictment and one of the 10 girls named in the federal indictment, compared them to Manson, I initially thought this is nuts. When I went back to all the reporting we'd done at the Sun-Times, it turns out that Kelly's ex-wife, Andrea, his second wife after Aaliyah, her parents were not allowed to talk to her. They never met their grandson. They were not allowed to visit the house, the home, anything. And they were using the word brainwashed, and that was in the early 2000s. I think this was happening the whole time. And even though I've been reporting on this story for so long, even I didn't realize until the summer of 2017 just how crazy this world surrounding R. Kelly was.
He's Jim DeRogatis, and you should check out his new book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. It is available now. When you talk about living with six women at a time, have you gotten close in your reporting to understanding what that looked like?
Yeah, I've seen pictures of where he housed them, and I've talked to some of the women, and I don't think cult was an exaggerated word. His defense will be these women were where they wanted to be, and they were of legal age, and we've seen some videos. He has a pipeline to TMZ of one or two of the girls who are still with him, or they're waiting high atop Trump Tower for him to get out of jail, and that's never going to happen again, Dan. Bail has been withheld on the federal charges brought in Chicago. He's being brought in handcuffs to New York for the federal charges filed there. He's never going to breathe fresh air again. The feds are going to not allow bail, the judge, the court system. Two of the young girls, Azrael Clary and Joy Savage, have released videos, and they're on YouTube. They're weird. They're bizarre. These young women keep saying, I love him, and I'm where I want to be, and yet they have this zombie-like, brainwash-like look to them. I've seen it before. I saw it in the 26-minute, 39-second videotape of the 14-year-old for which he was tried in 2008. Now the feds have four tapes of underage girls, and the 14-year-old, she was allegedly 14 when that videotape was made in late 1998 or very early 1999. She's now cooperating. But you think about that. He met her when she was 12 through her aunt, Sparkle, who was his next protege after Aaliyah. She sold 500,000 copies of the record that Kelly produced, and Sparkle broke away and wanted her family to separate her niece from Kelly. but that girl's been with him from 12 or 13 until just recently turning and becoming a witness for the federal government. It's horrifying. That's hit more than half her life. She's in her early 30s now. She had no life. She had no childhood. And her parents, you know, allegedly accepted money from Kelly to pimp out their daughter.
When you mentioned abuse from the sister, what do you know about that? And what is that his own admission?
In Solar Coaster, My Diary of Me, the autobiography he dictated to this hack named David Ritz, published by Tavis Smiley, by the way. He's always had supporters in high places. In Solar Coaster, he says an older woman in the house invited him to take pictures while she had sex with her boyfriend, eventually began having sex with him. He was 8 or 9. He subsequently told Tavis Smiley in a TV interview that it was a relative. And as I say, his brother, Carrie Kelly, and his former manager both went on the record and said it was his older sister. The sister has disappeared. His two half-brothers, Carrie and Bruce Kelly, have given interviews, and Carrie admits he was abused as well. And Bruce, in a really horrifying scene in Surviving R. Kelly, says, hey, everybody has different preferences. Me, I like older women. My brother, he likes younger women. It's just a preference. It's not a crime. Again, we're talking 12, 13, 14, 15. It's horrifying. You know, Teresa Kelly, the half-sister, has never been on the record, never spoken, has changed her name, is living elsewhere, and doesn't want to be found. Whether the thing about the sister is real or not, I don't know. Someone abused him, a family member, he says. That's what he has said directly in print.
Can you tell me, when you mention all of these cruelties, and you've mentioned plenty of them here, I mean, just awful things, treating people like whipped animals. What is the greatest of the cruelty?
I'll never be able to unsee that videotape, knowing that this girl was 14, hearing him command her, dance this way, urinate for me, open your mouth, and he urinates in her mouth. Call me daddy. He calls her by name, and he says, call me daddy. Having seen that, it's not something you can unsee. I think the reason I needed to write this book, Dan, and it's not a book I ever wanted to. I've written 11 books about popular music. I have, you know, a show on 125 public radio stations, Sound Opinions. I believe in the power of music. I never wanted to write this book. Believe me, I'd rather be writing about what I love. But I think people don't understand how this could happen and how he could have been acquitted, despite the jury having seen that videotape a dozen times in open court. The system was gamed. Justice was brought. A lot of villains, from the record company all the way down to the lowly tape operator or, you know, his drivers and handlers, saw this and did nothing. Until years later, some of them are now speaking out, becoming witnesses for the federal government or the state of Illinois. It's not any different than Epstein. It's not any different than Cosby. But what horrifies me about this story is the music. You know, the music is part of so many people's lives on the south and west sides of Chicago, but really around the world. If I Believe I Can Fly was your high school graduation song or your prom song, or Step in the Name of Love played at your wedding, an Ignition remix powered every backyard barbecue you've ever been to, to now accept that this man was singularly the worst predator in the history of popular music, which has a long history, like sports, of some men behaving very badly. But I'm unaware, having been a music journalist and critic since 17, I'm 54 now, of anyone who's ever faced charges so broad and deep as this man. You know, you're now being asked to turn on this music that was the soundtrack of your life, and it's really difficult. It's difficult with Michael Jackson. It's difficult with R. Kelly. And this is going to be one of the legacies of Me Too, is what do we do with the art when it has meant something to us? Can we still enjoy that?
It is almost impossible to believe that he got away with this for so long, given all of the clues that he was leaving elsewhere. Do you believe It's just because we don't know how to talk about this. We don't know how to research it. We can't fathom risking the life of a pedophile in jail for anything because that life is going to be worse. Is it just because we want to look the other way? Is that how Jerry Sandusky happens at Penn State? Other people don't want to look when Michael Jackson is just walking around with a six-year-old. It's easier to just make him Peter Pan.
There is this factor of we are so disgusted by these crimes that we don't want to address them. In Solus, I lay out everybody who was to blame, the churches, because Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend James Meeks, the number two at Rainbow Push, stood up for and defended Kelly. The politicians, he sang benefit concerts for the Black Congressional Caucus. The schools, he would go back to his high school choir class and prey on 15-year-old girls. Journalists, because aside from me and two colleagues at the Chicago Sun-Times, no one else picked up this story. The civil attorneys who took money rather than bringing these young girls to criminal authorities for criminal charges, the courts, him having gamed the system, bribed the key witness and her parents in the 2008 trial, and society at the end of the day, Dan, it's hard to say. I mean, with Nassar, that gym doctor, you know, or Sandusky is a good comparison. We don't want to believe this. You know, there's tawdry things in Michael Jordan's background and what Jordan meant to, you know, a generation of kids, and they were nothing like R. Kelly. But it's just we want our heroes, and we don't want to see them brought down. And I think that enables the monster to get away with almost anything.
Forgive me this, because I don't want to put you in a bad spot. I'm not sure why you inserted Michael Jordan in there. Do you know something that we don't?
Oh, no, it was just the gambling and the philandering, and there were lawsuits of affairs with women legal age. He was a human being, you know. He was, and the fact that Jordan and Kelly collaborated on Space Jam, Kelly wrote, I Believe I Can Fly for Jordan. I'm not, absolutely not saying Jordan's in that category. But we don't want to hear anything bad about our heroes, do we?
No, not really. How do we explain how he won the trial? Are you saying just the bribe of the key witness? That's all that had to happen there?
According to federal indictments that have come out in the last 2 weeks, he bribed the girl in the videotape, her father and her mother, to lie to the grand jury and to not testify in the trial, to say that that wasn't her on the tape, that there was no relationship. Other witnesses, according to the federal indictments, were threatened. If they couldn't be bought, and he tried to get other tapes that were in existence in 2002 through 2008, when it finally went to trial, he paid people to get those off the street. And when he couldn't pay somebody, he threatened them physically, or his people did. Two of them are indicted beside him, a former manager and a personal assistant. The system was gamed. Plus, you had a judge, Vincent Gaughan, who consistently ruled in favor of the defense more than 100 times in closed chamber hearings. Every 6 weeks for 6 years, which broke every record for the amount of time between indictment and trial in the history of the Chicago court system, every 6 weeks he would convene prosecution and defense and immediately retire to closed chambers. There is no transcript, there is no record of everything that happened during those meetings for 6 years. What was happening, I lay out in the book, was he was consistently ruling for the defense. The top child sexual abuse expert in the world, really, a woman named Dr. Sharon Cooper from down south, was set to testify, had studied the tape, was going to provide for the state evidence of why child sexual abuse victims often deny that it happened, and the judge said she could not testify. The judge would not allow any evidence about the girl and her family being paid off. He would not allow any evidence of what the Sun-Times had reported in December 2000, that this was a pattern of behavior. The name Aaliyah and the illegal marriage was never entered into evidence. It became all about one girl on one videotape, and she wasn't in court, and the jury didn't hear from her. So although they believed Kelly had done something, and they believed it was certainly him on the tape, they didn't hear from the victim, so he was acquitted. Plus, it was Father's Day weekend, and they didn't want to be sequestered. They wanted to go home. I mean, go back and look at what happened in the Simpson trial. It's hard to believe that with all the evidence, he's acquitted. And this happens if you have the money. He had four top attorneys, two of them who proudly called themselves mob lawyers, who were charging him for 6.5 years, $850 an hour.
How were the personal manager and the assistant helping procure women?
According to this indictment, the personal assistant would press the tiny balled-up piece of paper with Kelly's phone number into the hands of a girl. The former manager would, after Barry Hankerson, Daryl McDavid, threatened and intimidated witnesses. The federal prosecutors say that this is the tip of the iceberg. The investigation is continuing. I've heard accounts of many of his assistants taking young women for abortions when he impregnated them, pressing his number in their hands, driving them to his places of residence, not allowing them to leave. There was a village doing these crimes, and Kelly was certainly at the center of it. The money, the celebrity, and then this weird power of the music. And nobody wanted to derail that gravy train is the best way I can put it.
How much prosecution might they face?
The charges against Daryl McDavid and June Brown, the two who are named so far, are substantive. They can do years in prison. Beyond that, whoever else is charged, I think the goal is to get people to flip on Kelly and turn state's evidence. Yesterday, we saw a man who's alternately described himself as Kelly's spiritual advisor, crisis manager, or publicist, Daryl Johnson, was on CBS This Morning with Gail King. And Gail asked him, you have a 20-year-old daughter. Would you allow your daughter to be with Kelly the way Joy Savage or Azriel Clary are? And he said, I'd never allow my daughter to be with a pedophile. And he said it like three times in a row. And that was in the morning, and in the evening he resigned, allegedly for personal reasons.
What the hell was that? What's that?
We're in the bizarro world, Dan. You can't make this stuff up. You know, Kelly's attorneys, he's got three or four of them now. Steve Greenberg, the one who's been most vocally in the press, was profiled by Crane's Chicago Business with a headline that said, there is no greater thrill in the world than getting a guilty man acquitted.
Really?
Now look.
Are you shitting me? Are you shitting me?
Google it. Chicago Crane's Business. It's a profile.
So this guy is just, wait a minute. Hold on a second. He is quoted as saying, look, I'm just a slime bucket, and rationalizing it under, well, it's the laws. So this is a game where I'm just trying to win stuff.
Yes. Yes. And this was the same case with the attorneys in 2008. I mean, you know, what kind of an attorney proudly calls himself a mob lawyer? But that was Eddie Jensen and Sam Adam Sr. His son, Sam Adam Jr., was part of the defense team. Sam Adam Jr. is a character. He's half black, half white. He has billboards all over Chicago. If you're driving on the south side, the north side, on the highway, Sam will fight for you. And it shows him like a rabid pit bull screaming and yelling, pointing his finger. He also defended Governor Rod Blagojevich and got a mistrial the first time when Blagojevich was accused of trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat. And instead, he was first one was a mistrial, but then poor Rod was out of money. So Adam left him and no longer represented him. And then he got convicted and he's sitting in jail, a 10-year sentence. The governor. I mean, why Rod Blagojevich, for just being a moron, is doing more time than Kelly ever has, never made sense to anyone in Chicago.
Money. You mentioned money and having no money. Does he have money? Does R. Kelly have money? How can he afford all these lawyers? I thought I was reading reports that he didn't have money.
He sings in I Admit, the 19-minute long track, which is the last piece of music he'll ever release, really. Was floated on the net last summer. He sings, I am a broke-ass legend. You know, when he was indicted by the state of Illinois. He was jailed for 3 days and scrambled to raise the bail. Then he went to jail for 3 more days for not paying child support, scrambled to raise the bail. These mysterious female donors, older women, came up with money and got him out. He cannot, well, he's not allowed bail now, and I don't believe he will ever be. He keeps saying he's broke. I don't know. I believe these attorneys are working for him now on spec. He'll get out someday and the money will flow again. Or they're doing it for the fame and notoriety. Steve Greenberg certainly seems to love being in front of any camera saying his client is 100% innocent, and all of these women, all of the women who appeared in Surviving R. Kelly, the 48 women whose names I know and document in my book, they're all liars. All liars, Greenberg has said 100 times. Why they're working with Kelly, I don't know. Kelly does not seem to have any money left. The Mute R. Kelly movement, the activist group founded in Atlanta by Oronike Odele and Kenyette Tisha Barnes, has effectively shut down almost every concert he's tried to perform in the last 2 years since my story in 2017. So he can't perform and make money. Nobody's making money selling records anymore, and he can't record. He just asked the other day. He's in solitary confinement for his own protection. He cannot read or write, so what is he doing? Greenberg asked for a computer so he can finish his album while he's sitting in jail.
You mentioned those mysterious older women. Can you piece together any parts of the mystery?
There's been various reports by the local Chicago newspapers, you know, Sun-Times and the Tribune. One of the women owns, and you can't make this stuff up, a Christian daycare center and a restaurant. They have not wanted to be in the press. They've resented reporters inquiring into why they posted R. Kelly's bail. Some of them were pictured at his side at his arraignment and turning himself into jail. I don't know what that's about.
Did you get into the book much? Again, the new book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, is available now. I haven't heard anybody on this subject who is as informed as this guy. How much did you know about spending habits?
I've been hearing stories since November 2000. His favorite restaurant, mind you, this is a man who earned $250 million. His favorite restaurant is McDonald's. For years, he would stake out young girls looking for 15, 16-year-olds at the Rock and Roll McDonald's on Clark Street in Chicago. It's now become a new green McDonald's. But it was a cheesy wannabe hard rock cafe with, you know, a jukebox and stupid 45s from the 50s on the wall. And this is where the biggest name in R&B selling 100 million records would sit and have a regular table. And according to one lawsuit, you know, he picked up a girl on her high school prom. After her high school prom, she'd come into McDonald's with her cousin. They were both in their prom dresses with corsages. The dates waited in the rented limousine, and he picked up that girl after her high school prom. You know, so despite being incredibly rich, he was also weirdly cheap. There are many stories of him buying SUVs for people as a thank you, but I don't know. If I had that kind of money, I'd, you know, decide to take you to dinner in Paris tonight, Dan.
What did you learn from the federal indictments that you were surprised by? That must have been really interesting reading for you. Was there a lot of stuff in there that you did not know?
No. It's going to sound boastful. My feeling was amazement that here is everything I have been reporting for 20 years in black and white, verified by the federal government. From the girls being told how to dress, when to eat, when to go to the bathroom, to the bribery and intimidation and physical threats. Now, mind you, I never doubted that anything I've published in the book or in the 19 years that led up to it was not true. Not a word's ever been subject to a correction, a clarification, a retraction, or a lawsuit. But here was the federal government saying, here is our evidence against R. Kelly. 10 underage girls, 4 videotapes, evidence of bribery and witness intimidation, physical threats, and the way he had mistreated women living with him in Atlanta and Chicago in this cult. The world really seems to have crumbled on him. And it's about time. You know, why it took so long is what the book's about.
The federal indictment, you're not surprised by anything in there? Nothing?
I have never learned anything of substance from any other reporter or from the federal indictments. I've been reporting this story and reporting on these actions for a very long time. And there was nothing new in there to me. No. And, you know, reporters can be territorial about a scoop. And I never had that attitude. From the first story in December 2000, I was waiting for other reporters to jump on this and add things that I hadn't known.
It's too hard, Jim. It's too hard. What you did some heavy lifting there. But I can see a lot of lazy reporters not wanting to go down the path. I mean, for years and years and years, we didn't do much reporting of sexual allegations because it, I mean, for how many years was it he said, she said? You were one of the few people doing it.
Yeah, I guess so. But even now, since Jeffrey Epstein has been indicted a second time, for years it was Julia K. Brown alone at the Miami Herald reporting on him. But now New York Magazine and the New York Times and the Washington Post and a dozen other news organizations are breaking aspects of that story. But I think because of race being a factor, it seems to be that many reporters are particularly daunted by the task of reporting on young black girls. And I don't understand that, because Abdon Palish is this short, self-professed Irish Polish leprechaun, as what he calls himself and his bosses have called him. And I am a fat white rock critic. We rang those doorbells on the south and west sides of the city starting in November 2000. And people were so eager to welcome us into their living room and tell us how they or their loved ones had been hurt. You know, it didn't matter that we were white. What we kept hearing again and again and again is no one ever wanted to listen. Thank you for letting us tell our story. And it was never hatred. Really interesting. It was never that SOB needs to be thrown away in jail and lose the key. It was brother's sick. Brother needs help. Brother's got to stop. That's the single most common phrase I've heard.
What is that, though? What's happening there?
I think everybody realizes that this man is really sick. And despite the personal pain he's caused so many people, they just want to see it stopped. There's an admiration for the music and for him, and even an empathy and a sadness about whatever happened to him as a child to make him so messed up today. It was rare until 2017 to hear anybody say, I hate this man. Certainly now, the Clary family and the Savage family, they despise him. They want their daughters back. Those girls have been with him for 3 years with no contact whatsoever with anyone in their family. And the evidence is out there now in a federal indictment and in my story since July 2017 of how those girls are being mistreated, now young women in their early 20s. Those families hate him for sure. But for years, I think people just saw this as a tragedy. They loved Marvin Gaye, everybody in R&B, and he had a messed up life. And people were like, this man's a genius. It's sad. I think people feel that way about Jackson, Michael Jackson. His music has touched so many people. What happened to him, his upbringing, his abusive father, is sad. And I don't think anybody holds hate in their heart.
That just doesn't make any sense, though, the idea that his music has touched so many people, so Michael Jackson gets to touch so many people. Like, what is that? Like, it just seems...
Oh, no. Well, I think you're dismissing the way that artists and celebrities or, you know, put it back in your field, sports heroes, you know, touch your life. And you don't want to believe the worst in them. And I don't think empathy is a bad thing. I think empathy is too rare these days for other people, trying to understand other people, which is not to say that any of this should have been a pass. Don't misunderstand me. Nobody thinks he should have ever done this and gotten away with it. They just are profoundly sad.
Surprised, though, because one of the things that I'm surprised by here, Jim, is that the way those people are defending a sickness, the thing that I think of, if confronted with that information, I think that most of America would simply be appalled and not forgive the idea of sickness. I think they would judge R. Kelly as evil. Like, sickness is sort of letting him off, even though it might be true.
Go on what pop culture calls Black Twitter and search R. Kelly, and you will be horrified by the number of vehement defenders, of champions, of all of these women are lying. It is, once again, the media trying to bring down a successful black man. It is racist. It is all lies. And the people who, even some of those supporters who believe, they don't care. They just don't care. The music is so great. His genius is so great. I don't care. And that's obviously evidence of a much bigger problem in society. I think that my reporting reached a cumulative impact in the summer of 2017, and Dream Hampton, who directed Surviving R. Kelly, all 6 hours of it, said that was foundational, and that obviously made an impact. It broke all viewership records for the Lifetime Channel. It is now nominated for an Emmy. Even with all this evidence and people having met, courtesy of television, these victims, many people don't care and are still defending Kelly. It's a horrifying, but, you know, we're seeing this in many elements of society where people are very reluctant. They believe what they want to believe. The very nature of news, fake news, and what is factual is now up for grabs. I mean, geez, Dan, there's people who are arguing the earth is flat.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you ringing those doorbells, wandering around the neighborhood? What can you tell us to paint that picture?
As I say, people invited us in and cried on our shoulders, me and Abden Palish, and were eager to tell us what was going on. If you talk to four women anywhere on the south or west side of Chicago, three of them are going to have a story of R. Kelly cruising Kenwood Academy or Whitney Young High School, the Evergreen Plaza shopping mall, the rock and roll McDonald's. This was never a secret that he was preying on girls in the black community. And I can't emphasize enough that, you know, people say, why did you stay on the story 19 years? The courage of these women in telling their stories, in speaking out, and then opening themselves up to waves of hatred in their own community, especially with social media now. They're liars, bitches, hoes, gold diggers. You know, nobody, I think, speaks out about sexual assault. Not Dr. Anita Hill or Christine Blasey Ford, and not R. Kelly's victims for fame. It took 9 months to report the cult story in July 2017. And the parents, the Savages and the Clarys, had not spoken to anyone at that point for 9 months. And I had to go to three different news organizations and finally published it with the fourth, BuzzFeed, despite 14 sources on the record and documentation proving what was going on. It wasn't as if journalism was eager to tell that story. And it certainly wasn't as if those parents for 9 months were just doing this for fame. They were eager to try anything they could to help get their girls home. And they still aren't home. As we talk, they're sitting in Trump Tower waiting for this man who they think loves them, despite the now documented abuse he has subjected them to.
Jim, what do you think would have happened here if one of the girls had been white or some of the girls had been white?
I, years ago, did a panel with Mark Anthony Neal, who's the chair of African American Studies at Duke University. He's a brilliant man, and he's a huge music fan who writes really great music criticism as well. And he said at that point, and this is 15 years ago, Jim, if it had been one white girl, this would have been a different story. Think about it, Dan. The number of white girls who disappear on a cruise or on vacation in Mexico, and it becomes 24/7 cable news. These were all black girls, except for one young Puerto Rican girl from Florida, Miami, Lizette Martinez. They were all women of color, and nobody cared. I think we, in general, do not believe any woman who is making an allegation of sexual assault. According to the FBI, only 4% ever turn out to be false, and that, you have to remember, 60% of sexual assaults are never reported. And then only 4% of the 40 that are turn out to be false accusations. Many rape victim advocate organizations say that's a conservative number, as befits the FBI. Very few false accusations ever are brought against any man, because what a woman faces when she steps in the spotlight and accuses a man is truly horrifying. These girls were particularly powerless. As young black girls, we were even less inclined to believe them. And that comes from having interviewed dozens of them and people in the criminal justice system. I am only repeating what so many young black girls and their loved ones have said. Nobody matters less in society than young black girls.
He is exceptional at his job, and this new book has a lot of stuff in it that he didn't give us here. He has been very generous with his time, but there is much more in the book. And if you want to know more, this guy has sold his book because he is an authority on this subject. It is Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. It is available now. Jim, thank you for being so patient with us, and thank you for spending this time with us. And thank you for your reporting.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the interest, Dan. It's really great to have somebody who cares. And sometime we'll have to get together and just talk about, I grew up in Hoboken, Jersey City, played in lots of bands with first-generation Cuban immigrants. Let's talk about the wonderful culture and music of that island, eh?
All right. You'll be our music critic.
Okay. I'm happy to do that.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
You bet.
I don't want to say I enjoyed that, given the subject matter, but I did find it hugely informative. Our thanks to Jim DeRogatis for the reporting he's done over the last two decades and for sharing as much time with us as he has. Brian Windhorst. We're going to go deep inside the soul of Brian Windhorst next week. We'll talk to you then.